Hello and welcome to the Maverick Radio Hour. This is a special edition where we have an interview with Tom Witcher over here. And we're going to go into some topics of interest. We met a few nights ago. What was it, last week?
Yeah, sometime last week, early last week, I think. Monday, Tuesday, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. One of those days. I found it interesting. I think we got into talking about investments, particularly.
Yeah, equity investments mainly. You were interested in like what I did, and, you know, like the way I got by, my living, my work, and essentially what I told you was equity investments.
Equity investments.
Yeah. Stocks, essentially.
So equity investments. What makes the? Why are they equity investments and not? Say, generic investment?
Equity is part ownership. And, stock specifically, in terms of equity, is share ownership in companies. So what interested me in that was I could buy a piece of a large corporation that I otherwise would have had no way of becoming a part of. So if I wanted to invest in a local business, I could probably contact the owners and try to buy a piece of their company. But if I wanted to get involved with a giant company, say like Walmart or McDonald's or something, I'd have to – there isn't an easy way to do that outside of just buying their shares. But there's a lot of potential to make money through buying their shares and giving your resources to corporations that essentially make – their money from yours and then give you a return based off what you gave them.
Right. So that's the difference between equity investment and
so
you're getting a portion of the company.
Yeah. That's a simple way to put it. But yes, stocks specifically are buying a piece of a company.
Right. And so you make the money on those from the dividends then.
No, not necessarily. Some stocks that you buy will pay a dividend, and that's usually a small, either a fraction of a percent or just a teeny percent of what you've invested in them, and they'll give that annually. So you'll get, say you put $10,000 in a company, and they give a 1% dividend, you'll get $100 every year, something like that. But usually it's not that high. Typically dividends are relatively small. For me, stocks, really the way that someone could make a significant amount of money off of them is capital gains. So it's your shares growing in value over time. And when you sell them, that's when you actually recoup what you put into the company. So if you put in, you know, $1,000 in Tesla 2 years ago, it'd be worth $20,000 today. And that's where the big gains are made through capital gains.
That's crazy.
And the beauty of capital gains as well is they're not taxed until you sell. And there's two types of tax brackets. There's short-term capital gains tax and then long-term capital gains tax.
Okay. I was about to ask about that because it sounded like they were talking about capital gains taxes lately in Congress, talking about putting that as a part of this package or something.
Things are always changing, albeit small changes. Usually NASDAQ, big pools where companies market themselves and allow their shares to be sold. There's the government's always been involved with them, and they all, you know, the government always wants to make money on your money. So
yeah,
that kind of thing's changing all the time. But long-term capital gains taxes are relatively small in comparison to short-term.
That is to say, long-term would incur when you held on to a stock for a fair amount.
X amount of years, I believe it's 15 right now.
Okay,
but. Yeah, that's what discourages a lot of people from doing like day trading or something where you'd buy a share that day, hope that it blows up, and then sell it immediately.
Right.
Unless your profits are extremely high, the tax probably is going to hurt a little bit, you right. know, whereas this long term, you can kind of, you negate that effect, essentially, especially if it's something you've held for a long time and you've made a fair return on that. And I mean, fair return, I mean like a few 100%.
Okay. What I always thought that was strange about this, too, the day trading style thing, where you buy in the morning and then you sell it in the afternoon and then you make X amount on the difference.
Sure.
It almost seemed like, I mean, what's really happening in that interim, do you think? Because it seems to me that if someone was buying in the span of a day, you're not going to have much of a practical difference between what the company was doing in the morning and what it was doing in the afternoon. I mean, maybe they finally finished making all those widgets that they've been working
sure.
on for the year, and they finally came out. And
tangibly, like, probably nothing. So the stock market and the valuation of shares is essentially what people think that it's worth. So it's speculative in a lot of ways. The things that I try to invest in usually aren't speculative, but Digital World Acquisition Corporation, I think DWAC, yeah, they're an example of a speculative jump where that company essentially had the same value as a company, but over a span of the last month, they've gone up from $9 a share to $100, but you know, politics get involved, and then a rumor's heard, and then the speculative value went back down, so now they're at, like, $60 a share. And they've only been around 3 months, and they're extremely volatile, going from $9 to $90 and now back down to $60.
Well, that's not too bad. I mean, you take, like, 10 steps forward and 3 back, you still moved ahead a little bit.
Not if you came in early. It would be bad, though, if you were somebody who bought it at $90, thinking they were going to be $200, you know.
Right.
Now you've lost 30-ish percent of your investment. Although you never truly lose your money until you sell, and you never truly gain your money until you sell your shares either. You always have that ownership in the company regardless.
Okay. So in a lot of cases, that's just, you would say, confidence in that company. And that changes based on people's, you know, just their sentiment toward it.
Yeah, with speculative investments, it's a lot like a painting or a piece of art. It's what people believe that it's worth. Not necessarily what it's actually worth. So I try to avoid those kind of things. There's a lot of money to be made in that. And certainly there's,
you can sway people.
Exactly, yeah. There's definitely people that have made a lot of money off of speculative investments, but I prefer to lean on the side of value investing, which is where you take the actual assets of the company, look at ratios like price to book value, see add up all their shares in the company, and that's what the company's worth. You could buy the company if you bought every single share of the company available, given that everybody would be willing to sell their shares as well. And if the book value of the company, say you own the company owns a building and the building's worth $500,000 and the stock is, trying to keep this really simple because I don't want to get ahead of myself with the math, but say there's 100 shares and they have a building worth $500,000 and there's only it's only $10 a share, so the whole company is worth $10,000 essentially. You'd know that even if they liquidated, even if they lost all of their value in terms of what their shares are worth, they could sell their building and you would get more back from that than you would have had at the $10 mark,
right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if the company owns the building, they have that, and it's worth X amount of dollars, then, you know, during that liquidation period, if they sold that. So they would have to go basically bankrupt or, you know, throw in the towel on their, you know, actual business.
Yeah, that's not good for the company. No, going out of business is never good for a company. But as an investor, it's a good consideration to have, because if you can see something's true value, regardless of what people think of it or try to give their opinion on what it's worth based off something intangible, I think that it means more, and usually you're going to come out better if you focus on what the company is physically worth and their potential to grow to, which is another aspect. In my mind, there's three main ways people invest in stock, and that's speculative, like we just discussed, like paintings, essentially what people think things are worth. Value investing, where you know what they have and what the actual price should be based on the shares and their assets. And then there's also growth investing. So you see the potential for growth in an industry. Going back to Tesla, that's one of the few growth investments I ever made, as I saw electric vehicles is something that would change the automotive industry entirely and would continue to grow and build.
Mm-hmm.
In 500 years, I don't see anybody driving gasoline cars. So that was kind of my look on that. But
Seems about right. And there's a limited amount of oil in the earth.
Exactly. It's a finite resource.
Yeah, it is. Now, how long that resource lasts, you know, the estimates that we had back in the 70s clearly didn't come out to be in the case. We didn't reach peak oil or
no,
that sort of thing in 2004, like a lot of people said there would be. And in fact, looking at, did you ever hear the, speaking of this, this is one of my pet research projects, Limits to Growth was a book put out by the Club of Rome in the late 60s, I believe it was, early 70s. And they were positing this pretty much this very thing, like oil, for instance, can only go so long. It's a limited resource, so you know, X amount of measures ought to be taken, and it would be smart to do so before this particular year, that sort of thing.
Sure, and especially something that's like a fossil fuel. There's other considerations to that as well, like how is it affecting the earth. It's finite.
It is.
How much really is there? Do we know how much there is? Can we actually measure that? Are our measurements accurate?
Well, that's the thing that's really weird, too. And most recently, there was an update to this, particularly from the Club of Rome themselves, who said, oh, yeah, remember that estimate that we gave about how much oil there was in the earth? Actually twice as much.
we were wrong by 100%.
wrong by 100%. Oh, yeah, well, yeah. At the same time, so we don't exactly know how much is actually in there.
And nobody could ever truly... No, it's not like it's in a vial and we can see where it's marked off exactly,
right.
You know.
That's the case. But the growth investment, that was for Tesla.
Sure.
So clearly at some point, you know, electric vehicles are going to be the way to get around, unless we're in electric planes.
Yeah, exactly. That's another consideration. I mean, for me, when I looked at Tesla, they had already established themselves as a business. They were already producing vehicles. I was driving around in my gas car and seeing people drive around in electric ones. And that's when I really believed in them and made a decision to invest in their company. But that was sort of safe, in my opinion. There's like you're talking about, maybe a company comes out and they create small, accessible, affordable flying electric vehicles. And if you got in that early enough and you saw the potential for them to grow, that would certainly be a good growth investment. If you believed in it and you thought what they could do was something that they could pull off.
Yeah, maybe they could. Or we'll get those jetpacks.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Really, yeah.
Love to have that. And then the other investment was the equity investment.
Well, equity is just a subsection of, or stocks are a subsection of equity.
Oh, okay. Oh, right.
So you have, like, stocks, bonds, they're shorts, you can bet against a stock, but you're not actually owning anything in those situations. So bonds you're loaning money to a corporation to use your money, and you get a return based off what they say that they'll pay you, essentially. And for me, my focus has always just been owning a piece, because I don't when I put money into something, I don't really want to give somebody money in hopes that they'll return my money back with interest. I'd rather buy a piece of the company and own a piece of it.
Okay.
And understand that whatever their success is, I get my fraction of that success proportionate to the shares that I purchased.
Right. Makes sense. Now, the when you mentioned how much a company is worth in regard to, like, say, the building that they have,
sure,
that sort of deal, is that what? Because I heard this term some while back, the vulture capitalism, I think.
Vulture. I'm not vulture,
what was it? People accuse Mitt Romney's company of having. Doing this,
I didn't even know Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney had a company.
That's, yeah, well, he was at least tangentially, you know, related to some sort of company that they would come in when a company was on its last legs, and they were the ones who would be like, okay, we'll sell all your properties, and then we'll take a cut of it, and then pay off whatever people you owe,
whatever debt you have,
debt, yeah. So. I think they call.
I would consider that vulture.
Yeah,
yeah, coming in when something's almost dead, and yeah.
Yeah, cause it seems so because there's still some, there's some meat left on that dead body that that can be eaten up. And
exactly, that metaphor makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
there's lots of different names and metaphors that are used in the stock market.
You haven't seen something like that directly?
I've probably ran into it and forgot about it over time. The people who that I've been inspired by don't really get themselves involved with that kind of thing. They'd rather either buy something outright that is already succeeding at a fair value, or they see the opportunity for growth in something. Big money, taking advantage of essentially the death of another company. I'm sure there's a lot of money to be made, but it's never been my avenue or what I've involved myself in.
Right on.
Like
good.
It
seems like a positive philosophy in investment.
Yeah, and like the people that I've followed, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, these are the people that essentially own Berkshire Hathaway, and they have very high morale. And there's a difference between legal and ethical, you know. Something you can basically extort a company on their last limb and get the cheapest value out of that and take it over and probably make a fair amount of money, but is that going to work out better than putting money in something that is fundamentally good already and people you believe in, you already believe in their success? I don't know. That's a question that I can't really answer, but in terms of morale and ethics, I probably wouldn't get myself involved in that, although I would put my money in, like, Marlboro, however you pronounce it, or Camel, or a cigarette company, which technically kills people, and I smoke every now and then, but it's like, some people wouldn't invest because of that, but
right.
Everybody has their kind of circle of what they will or won't do based on their morale and their ethics. There's a lot of money to be made by jumping in on something when it's at its last leg and saying, I'll give you half of what you're worth, and they'll take it because they're desperate. But
right.
Yeah, not my thing, personally.
Well, that's probably good.
Fair enough.
I would say so. If I was the sort that invested, I'd probably be doing the same thing.
Sure.
Looking into the company themselves and seeing, okay, what do they have here that's really valuable that they're making that people want? And if they're doing that and they have some people at the forefront who you can really trust, who are, you know, going to continue doing what they do, then sounds like a good bet. Sounds like a good investment.
Yeah, and hopefully it is. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. I know we keep bringing up Tesla. Tesla almost failed multiple times. They were very close to bankruptcy. They were very close to not being able to make it. But they kept pushing, and they got to a point where now not only are they not just not going to make it, they're probably going to take things over. I mean, they're recently they hit the $1 trillion mark as a business, which is ludicrous. ten years ago, nobody, most people wouldn't have thought that, except maybe Elon Musk himself and, you know, the backers that they had at that time.
Well, that's incredible. Absolutely amazing. Was it just the other day? Was it just yesterday?
3 days ago, I think. Yeah. 2-3 days ago, something like that. They surpassed $1,000 a share on their stock. So, yeah, they hit the $1 trillion mark.
Wow.
And
it's incredible.
It really is, yeah. And we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, they may go under $1 trillion. At this point, though, they're probably not going to, in my opinion. It's like they've become the Ford of electric vehicles, in my mind.
Okay, so where does that, what does that trillion mean, that valuation? Is that the total amount of stocks and the total worth?
Exactly, yeah. That's what their stocks add up to. So each individual share, if you added them together, they'd be over $1 trillion. And there aren't that many $1 trillion companies, and certainly at the start of Tesla's existence, I mean, they were probably a multi-million dollar company, maybe a few hundred million dollars at the beginning. They surpassed the $1 billion mark. I don't know when, but I'd have to say not more than 5-10 years ago, and I'm guessing on that, but...
Okay. And then what does the company actually have a fair amount of this? This is just stocks, and so this is a measure of public confidence, would you say?
Well, with Tesla, I'd say that they didn't have a lot of public confidence at the start, and there's still big corporations that discount them. I mean, lots of financial, like newspapers, article writers, things of that nature said that, you know, Tesla's worst case scenario, they're going to be at $10 a share when they were at 50 or 70. And then they were 100 a share, 200 a share. Now, talking about it right now, they're over 1,000.
There we go.
Though, albeit very recently.
Clearly proving them wrong.
Yes, yeah, proving them wrong.
So what I'm getting at is the that actual share price, does that translate to, let's say, the company itself having more capital in order to build a better machinery or to hire more people to work?
Well, the share price it's speculative, and it's value based for Tesla, I'd say, at this point. When they started, they had factories creating, you know, tons of vehicles, thousands and thousands of vehicles every year. And now they've gotten to the point where they recently created what they called the Gigafactory. And that's kind of what has pushed it is people's opinion on it, their speculation of it, because they've seen that he's brought Elon, whoever you want to call it, Tesla as a whole, has brought the Gigafactory to fruition, and it's in existence now, and it was probably in a lot of people's minds something that was never going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what has bumped the share up recently. But okay. Stocks are...
I see you're getting...
Stocks all vary on what they are and people's opinion of them.
Okay.
But at the same time, it's beyond that too when you look at like straight value investing or like price to book value, because a company is worth X amount on paper determined by their book value, their assets, the buildings they own, the equipment they own, etc. And that gives you a book value. But then on top of that, people see the potential for growth with the company as well. I'd say that Tesla's still in some ways a growth stock, but they're getting, out of that plateau as they become more and more successful. Berkshire Hathaway is a company that's Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's company, and they own Geico. They own large portions of Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, things like that, and they're beyond where I would consider growth. They're at the point where you understand what they own. It's not likely they're going to fail. They own too much to fail. And their stock is more so driven by their profits and how they continue to make money and grow from the investments they've already made that are essentially safe. You know, you're probably not going to lose money in investing in giant banks or insurance companies.
Yeah.
And
well, interesting you mentioned profits there.
Profits. Yeah.
Ultimately, the one might very well lead to the other. As if you have a prophet who is saying, like, oh, well, this is what's going to happen in the future, and the company knows that. Let's say that, for instance, people are going to be buying electric vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, some prophet came out and said that.
Certainly,
and
yeah.
Thus, if you have a company that builds electric vehicles, that company is going to be making profit.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure people have tried before, and it's taken a long time for them to get where they're at today. Like, at the start, they almost failed multiple times. They created a more of like an exclusive kind of vehicle, a really, really, really expensive, unaffordable, not very fast, hard to get car that you'd have to wait on back order for a very, very long time to get. And the range was limited, and it really didn't do that well at the start. But as they progressed and they changed their mindset to affordable vehicles, somewhat affordable vehicles, depending on who you ask, they've grown substantially by giving people the opportunity to jump in who aren't, you know, multimillionaires, and it's not like an exclusive club kind of thing.
Just bigger market share.
Exactly.
Yeah, people who can afford the vehicles. This is something that that I've heard was especially important about Henry Ford when he put out the Model T, Model A, is that they were priced. He really hit the next level on these vehicles when they were priced at a level that his own workers could afford them. Such that if you were working in the Ford factory and you were working on that assembly line, you weren't just someone who was building something for the aristocracy, but you were building something that you could actually afford yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. From what I know, you know, modernized the assembly line and made it possible for mass production of a vehicle at a somewhat affordable rate at the time. And yeah, it made him rich. His company is still extremely rich. Yeah, and that's kind of where Tesla's gotten to. The technology was already there, but they had a lot of hurdles to jump through aside from just assembly. It was, you know, people trying to fight for normalcy in their mind, like gas cars are what they are, and that's not going away, and we're going to fight you until you go away because we want to make our money.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of industrial competition there.
Yeah, along with the legal side of it too. Big companies lobby to try to get their laws passed to make it harder for other new modernized things to come in and replace them, because they don't want to be replaced. They want to keep making their money.
Yeah, that's right. That's something I talked about today on my show, is just a little bit, didn't go into it too deeply, but planned obsolescence and the fact that the companies tend to want to keep making the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately that comes down to the fact that they're a little worried and they're fearful about what might happen when, let's say, you know, everyone has plenty of light bulbs for the rest of their lives. What are you going to do with the light bulb factory? What are you going to do with the workers?
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
Planned obsolescence is something that's kind of fundamental in almost every single tech market. And it's interesting, too, because if you have an iPhone, if you have like an iPhone 5 or something like that, Apple will give you a newer model phone because the way that phone functions now isn't going to keep up with their modern iOS.
Yeah.
And they want you to still be a part of their system and not switch to Android or something.
They want to update those systems too, the programming, the software within them.
Exactly, and that's limited by the hardware. So, yeah, if you have a super, super, super old iPhone, they'll probably give you a new one just to keep you from switching to Android.
Now, in my the way I usually do things, I kind of like the quality over quantity. I like to have something that, you know, you look at a really good piece of furniture. That piece of furniture is supposed to last, you know, 50, 70 years. If it's made out of good, solid, hard wood, and it's stained well, and it's taken care of. Yeah. You don't just leave it out in the rain or anything.
No. But you probably could if it was really well made for a little bit. Yeah, that's
if it's really well made, yeah.
Agreed, good. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's an ideal on that front. And I'm hoping that one way or the other, that sort of quality of a product can be brought into and made in a similar manner that that planned obsolescence has become a standard model for a lot of product creation. How do we turn that around such that the opposite is true?
I don't think you ever will, and I think the reasoning behind that is that they want to keep making their money, and they want you to keep having to buy the newest iPhone. They want you to keep buying the newest car. I don't ever really see, as things are now, I don't see there ever being like a circumstance where a company will put their all into something and say, okay, this is going to last forever. If it's tech or something you really need, high-end watches will probably last forever. If you buy a Rolex or something like that and take good care of it, it's probably going to last more than your lifetime. Mm-hmm. But you don't need it, you know. It's a timepiece. People need cell phones in today's society. People need vehicles.
That seems a bit unfair in that case.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think there's the reasoning behind it is they know that they're going to make money, and if they can create a circle of them getting to sell essentially the same product every year, altered slightly, improved slightly, they'd rather do that than give you something that they work on for 5 or 10 years, which is going to last significantly longer.
Well, who's they in this case? Why would they want to do that? Why wouldn't they
money.
Want to make something of quality? If it is arbitrary to go one way or the other,
Well, for them, I don't think it is arbitrary. For them, I think it's financially driven. I think that their goal is strictly make money. I don't think Apple puts out a new product anymore to revolutionize anything. I don't think they're making, they make their camera 4K. I don't really think that was, like, in their mind, I don't think they're like, okay, we're going to change the way everybody takes pictures. I think that they just had the technology. It was viable for them to do it in a large scale, and it could make them more money because they had another thing to market for their newest edition of something that was essentially the same. Now, that's not to say that like a iPhone 12 or whatever they're at now, 13, I don't even know, is the same as the original iPhone, because they're not. They're obviously different.
Yeah.
But that took place over, 10 years? Something like that. It's
the small... 2008, 2007, I came out with the first one, I want to say.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But I think a lot of things are designed to intentionally become obsolete, like we were talking about. But that's not to say that Apple's not a good stock to invest in, because there's a lot of money to be made on that kind
Very
of
true.
Marketing strategy, selling strategy.
Well, the thing is, I see it as, in either case, I believe that a company, as long as they're making a product that people want and they're going out and buying, it's definitely a good bet to invest in them, for sure.
That's one of the key markers that I keep in mind is, why would people want this? Is it something that makes sense for them to buy? And do they need to buy it? But that's not to say that somebody could come out tomorrow and create like a hologram phone or something, you know, way beyond the technology that everybody has as standard now, and they could still fail. There's lots of companies that have tried to be on like the cutting edge of things, like Sharper Image, for example. I think they're out of business now, but they were always like on the cusp of like, we're going to put out the weirdest, newest, most different tech that you probably haven't seen before.
And the magazines that have those catalogs.
Yeah, I think so. They had a store on the plaza for a long time, but not anymore.
Well, that's some interesting stuff, and it reminds me of the product explosion that came out in the 80s that they hopped on with. And one of the things that I associate with that is like, what did you call those? The balls that had the looks like the lightning bolts.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
you put your hands on it, and then
the light would come up. It would look like lightning.
Like
yeah.
Yeah, I mean those are absolutely fascinating.
Exactly.
It's incredible. Who made that? Where did that even come from? Why don't we know the guy's name?
Yeah, exactly. Really, why don't we know his name?
I mean, absolutely incredible, just crazy technology that it shows up and like something like a lava lamp too.
Yeah.
Like, what is this? Where did this come from? Who built it? And it doesn't even seem that those things were even necessarily patented either, because they're being made by a bunch of different companies.
Sure.
As I learned when I was a rep for Cutco Knives a while back, that and also the reason that Cutco Knives, you sell those from door to door, same with Mary Kay, is that the knife itself is patented such that, and this is why they did it with vacuum cleaners as well for a long while, that you'd have vacuum cleaner salesmen go from door to door, is because there's certain aspects of consumer patents that if you don't release them to other companies to make, then you can't put your product in a retail store.
Sure.
Such that you have to sell it in that sort of manner, which I find kind of odd. But what do you think about that?
Well, if we're talking about things that are... Well, let's go back to like the electron ball or whatever you want, or like a lava lamp. Nobody really needs that. You know, it's more of like an aesthetic piece or just something for fun. And that's not to say that things for fun can't be successful. I'm sure there's probably a 100 different fidget spinner companies that are still making money to this day. And that's just something for people to play around with.
Yeah.
But when I'm looking
at novelties.
Yeah. When I look to pick a stock, I look to find something that has a moat around it. So, like, you have to buy it or you need it. And I'm not trying to do that because, you know, I want to screw my fellow man over. It's because I'm buying food, I'm buying gasoline, I'm buying cars. Like, it's things that you have to have. It essentially creates a moat around the business. Yeah, exactly. And if you're not doing that, then you're fundamentally held back in some way. You don't have a car, you have to ride the bus. You can't eat, you'll die. It creates either a situation where somebody actually like really, really needs it, or it changes their life in such a drastic way that it's just irrational for them not to have it. Mm-hmm. Like,
okay. Yeah. So in which case, one of the things I noticed, kind of in a lot of respects, is that most people seem to have everything that they need. And what do you think? Do you think we're heading toward a post-consumerist sort of world as a result of such a thing?
It depends on what the average person will accept. It seems to me that it's also like there's geographical differences with owning a car. So if you live in New York or Chicago or something like that, maybe it makes more sense for you to walk or take the bus or ride a bike or ride an electric bike or something like that.
The subways are really awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Other forms of public transportation or personal transportation that aren't cars specifically, it may make sense in that area to not buy a car, but across the U.S., most people don't live in very big cities where everything they need is right next to them or in a short distance, and having the freedom to drive from point A to point B makes sense for most people in their circumstance if they can afford it. And I would bet that most people that, say you're 18 and you have no money and your parents kick you out or something, and you have no choice but to ride the bus or walk in like an area like a suburb, you'd want a car probably, and that would be the next thing on your checklist as you like got a job and started to make money, would be to get a loan for a vehicle, because it would change your life in such a drastic way.
Yeah.
And allow you to do, you know, work at a building that was significantly further from where you were just working because you were limited by public transportation or your own foot walking or a bicycle or something like that. Mm-hmm. So in some aspects, cars have a moat around them, and others they don't. But food certainly does, and insurance certainly does. If you own a car, you have to have insurance. It's a law, you know.
Yeah.
You have to pay that money to that corporation.
I don't think that's a bad law either.
No,
I
think at a minimum, it's a liability insurance.
Machine,
yeah,
you know, if you really want to turn it into one.
Oh yeah.
So you got to be able to. Having something to backstop that and to take care of business.
And that's probably why it was brought into law, is people were, you know, killing people accidentally or this or that. They had no way to pay the people's medical expenses or whatnot, you know.
Yeah. So someone just gets up and leaves after that, you know, and then they're like, oh, well, what happened to that guy? How are you going to get your recompense back? Oh, well, he ran off.
Or we know who he is and he has no money to be taken.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know.
Makes sense for it to go along with it. But concerning cars, I heard that the cars were just a fad and the horse was here to stay.
I don't know. You were mentioning the potential for an electric flying machine. Who's to say that cars are the end-all be-all for personal transportation? I don't know. Probably not. But I'd say that for the time being, they are.
Yeah, they are.
Just because I don't know much about, like, airspace or, like, planes or the government policies on who can be in the air and who can't. But I would imagine that it's significantly harder than, you know, what we have in place already set up, where we have roadways designed for the average person to be able to comprehend them and understand them and navigate. Yeah. Through a town and not kill a whole bunch of people or destroy a whole bunch of property.
I find it quite fascinating, too. The traffic itself is quite the ballet. That when you know how to drive your vehicle and you understand the rules of the road, and that other person knows how to drive their vehicle and understands the rules of the road, you're driving around at 70 miles an hour, feet away from another vehicle, and on a regular basis, and everyone gets along fine.
Yeah, and that infrastructure has been around for a long time, and I've known people that have never driven a car before, but have, you know, gone to driving lessons, gotten their license, and they get out, and they haven't killed anybody yet or destroyed anything. So we have a system set up right now where you can be ludicrously above average IQ, and you can be ludicrously below average IQ, and you can still get through the city and not hurt anybody or destroy anything.
Yeah, true enough. So I think you're right about the cars there, and about the practical benefit of the investments that you're going for. And yeah, that makes total sense. It really does. If I had some money, and I was putting it into something, I'd probably do something similar.
Sure.
In that realm of things. At the same time, when I think about what I would do with a lot of money, as opposed to investing it, I I'd invested in my own ideas.
Well, that's an investment in itself, yeah. Well, the best investment you can ever make is in your own knowledge, in my opinion, because that opens the door to whatever, stocks, your own business, whatever it is, a creative endeavor.
Well, that's investing, investing your money in that, and you can also invest your time in that. I'd like to say thank you all for investing your time in this special edition of Maverick Radio Hour. We've been here with Tom Witcher talking about investments, the value of equity, where it can go, what you can do with these sorts of things, some of the basics, and a little bit extra on the
fundamentals. Yeah, and some little caveats about cars.
A little bit of some caveats about cars. So hope you enjoyed the show, and we will be back with you another time, perhaps later. Would you like to join again?
Yeah, I'd be open to that, certainly, yeah. All right. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it. It's been fun.
Yeah, for sure. Glad you're here. I learned a few things, and hopefully y'all learned something, too. And this is thanks to Tom Witcher for being here.
Yeah, thank you,
Gary. Appreciate it. And this has been Maverick Radio Hour Special Edition, where myself and he are both wishing you peace, love, harmony, justice, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.